We are ready for our next speaker, Michelle T., author, editor, co-founder of Sister Spit, spoken word tour, and host of the Radar Salon series at the Harvey Milk branch of the San Francisco Public Library. And there happens to be one coming up this Tuesday at 7 p.m. with writers Katja Noyes and Tara Jepsen. Please welcome Michelle T.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to read this. Hi. Hey, after this is over, I'm going to put a little sign-up list if you guys want emails about the readings that I do, the Radar Reading Series, the Sister Spit Tour that I'm doing again. Put your name down. I'll send you an email. This may be interesting to no one but me, and I'm hoping that's not true. I wrote it for a book called Love Castro Street that's an anthology of queer neighborhoods in San Francisco, and it's about this punk house I used to live in that is no longer, doesn't exist anymore. It's called A Brief History of the Blue House. This is a story about 251 14th Street, known far and wide in legend and myth, gone down, down, down in history forevermore as the Blue House. When I moved into the Blue House, I was 23 and had only just moved into this other flat over on Harrison, a house full of bitches, political ones, the worst. So self-righteous in their attitudes, so smug about the cucumbers submerged in their home pickling juice in those big rustic jars with the little cockroaches scuttling over the glass. Despite a lifetime of poverty, I had never cohabitated with cockroaches, a point of pride in my family. We were broke, but we weren't gross. It wasn't the cockroaches that drove me out. As you will soon learn, I can roll with the roaches fine if I must. It was Joellen, my political roommate, telling me in that voice that we must learn to exist alongside other species. And so that was why the roaches ran rampant over the smugly home-pickled pickle jars and elsewhere. Flicking on the lights in the kitchen after sundown was such a terror, the awful leap of the bugs beneath the sudden glare. Oh, fuck Joellen. Joellen, who said I walked too heavy up the stairs each night as I returned home from the bar. Who was so intense about her pirate radio broadcast that my aforementioned footsteps could disturb the recording of, was so goddamn pleased with the possibility of being arrested for her pirate radio broadcast, who breathily informed me of what I should do if the FCC ever came for her, who taped a printout of the instructions by the door. Joellen, who scolded me for keeping my bedroom door closed too much, saying that I wasn't allowing my energy to enter the home. But I only came home to masturbate, write in my journal, and wait till I could go to my girlfriend's house, where everyone was fun and talked shit and drank 40s, which was also a problem. I wasn't home enough either. Well, I'm working a lot, I said. At Forest Forever, I hastily added, saving Headwaters Forest from Pacific Lumber, whose CEO looted the pension funds of the workers, and I launched into my nightly telephone script, but Joellen wasn't impressed. Do you really have to work so much, she challenged. I was saving up to go on a road trip with my girlfriend. Plus, I was poor. Yeah, I do, I snapped. I'm on GA, she bragged. I gave my notice and found, at the very last minute, a room on the second floor of 251 14th Street, a shitty little stretch of the Mission, run-down homes on one side, shifty late-night carjacking operations in the warehouse across the street. All night long, the car alarms on the stolen vehicles sang. Next door was a crappy little corner market reselling cigarettes that plainly had "Do Not Resell" stamped on the cellophane. Possibly they also ran a lottery scam of sorts. I got booze there and those cigarettes and big orange jugs of Tampico for nutrition. Further down the block was a legit auto shop, an old guy who fixed classic cars and kept big dreadlock junkyard dogs chained up and barking behind the chain link. A little laundromat on the corner. That was it. All around us, the Mission roared, the hippie selling produce at Tiny Rainbow on 15th Street, the homeless selling stuff on blankets directly across the street, drugs another block down by 16th, by the 16th Street Bart hole, but on our little stretch, nothing. Just the first floor's crack-addicted cousin who would occasionally sit on the steps, obsessively sweeping the crumbs from the cement. Just an occasional band of teenage boys who would select our ungated stoop to drink their bottles at. No big whoop, really. It was home for 7 years. When I moved into the Blue House in 1994, the primary tenant was a quiet straight girl who was obsessed with Aleister Crowley and the Civil War. She had spells in Italian written on her ceiling. She stayed up late watching sci-fi programs in the dark living room, her mean cat nestled into her pajamas. You'd think it was nice a cat wanted to sit on your lap, but this cat would settle down, and when it was time for you to get up and go about your life, it would try to scratch your eyes out. I avoided it. The Crowley girl ate meat. Amazing. I didn't know any people who ate meat and naively thought maybe most people had stopped. The other roommate was from another country, maybe Holland, and she did both Egyptian belly dancing at a Middle Eastern restaurant and naked pole dancing at a North Beach strip club. She was straight too.
The best thing about the Blue House was that it was two fast blocks from the Bearded Lady Cafe. The Bearded Lady was the Dyke Cafe. A trio of very cute butch dykes owned it and served up endless coffee and sandwiches and vegan soups. I lived there. Everyone did. The back patio would be packed with lingerers and loiterers, people who apparently had no jobs, no responsibilities, no ambitions, outside wasting away another gloriously sunny San Francisco day, sitting at the metal tables, smoking their hand-rolled cigarettes and getting all hopped up on coffee. Some folks brought their pipes and did hippie speedballs, exhaling their moldy smoke up into the fluffy white flowers that hung the fence that separated the cafe from someone's backyard, where kids kicked balls around and hollered. Stevie, who ran the Bearded Lady, used to live in the Blue House, too. Amazing. Yeah, she said, it was this big dyke household. Stevie lived there when she was a broke outlaw, and everyone else who lived there were broke dyke outlaws, too, pulling scams to make the insanely cheap rent. Stevie told me that Liberty lived in my room and put those bolts and metal rings into the floor to tie her lovers down and fuck them on the hard wood. Oh, wow, I said. Wow. Liberty was a sort of famous sex worker, a prostitute, and I saw her in this documentary someone made all about the dyke strippers and prostitutes, because there were like a million of them, and there was Liberty, but that was the only time I saw her, on the big screen like that, though now I lived in her room. Marty, who I had been in love with, had lived there too, crashing in the back room we didn't even rent out now. It was Crowley Girl's office, with her computer and more Italian hocus pocus on the walls. A girl named Scream had lived there. She was a stripper too. Maybe she'd been Marty's girlfriend, and they both lived there with Marty's dog that she'd rescued, and they didn't pay any rent because they didn't have jobs. They just found ways to illegally procure money, and before that, they were living down in a van somewhere. Marty was hot. Her outlaw sheen was totally real, unlike those pirate radio poser bitches from the other house, and I was glad she had lived in mine. Marty wasn't on GA either. She was on SSI, which was serious. You had to go to court and convince the judge you were nuts. And Marty and all her friends would take turns going into court and testifying how fucking crazy each other were to get these piddly checks from the state, which went far when you lived at the Blue House. Lana Little lived there too and made a film in the bathroom. Oh, I should explain the bathroom. There were three. One had a shower, a rusting tin box that was scary to use with ragged, gangrenous holes in the center. Later, the landlord replaced it with the regular cheap plastic one. That shower room also had a little sink, and that was it. Next door was a water closet, just a toilet, and across the hall was the big, marvelous bathroom where Lana shot her film, a takeoff on the sort of lesbian culture that these girls defiantly were not. It was called Women Loving Women, and it featured a bunch of granola-esque lesbos getting gangbanged by a crew of ferocious dildo-wielding SM dykes. It was shot in the big bathroom with the clawfoot tub and the toilet and the sink. A final girlfriend of Marty, who perhaps had had a million girlfriends, had also lived there, a radical femme stripper who placed personal ads in the paper looking for butches for her and her radical femme stripper girlfriends to group fuck in the bathroom at the stud. Tour updates from Annie DeFranco's mailing list came in the mail for her for years after I lived there, as did calendars from the local SM lesbian organization for Stevie. Shortly after my arrival, Crowley Girl and the belly dancer moved out, allowing me to revert the flat back to its destiny as a glorified crash pad for fucked up queer girls incapable of living a normal life and paying a normal rent. We need those houses, man. First came Jan. She was a referral from a friend who had neglected to mention her huge IV drug habit. Jan moved in, a punk girl with bleached, teased hair and bright synthetic clothing. The first weekend she was there, she fucked her best friend's girlfriend in the water closet after shooting them both up with ecstasy. Ecstasy? Can't you just swallow that? A couple times I worried that Jan might die, like when she called me into her bedroom and said, check in on me on and off to make sure I don't die. Okay, I said. I wondered if I should ask Jan to leave. I didn't. She cut her hair like a boy and got rid of the bright clothes, wearing mostly black jeans and booze-themed t-shirts. Jan was butch under all that new wave. She switched from shooting up to pounding beers with some routine drug binges. Like normal, I thought. After she quit the needles and all the shadiness that goes with them, we became the best of friends. And one night in her room, both of us manic drunk like we got, both of us wanting to get it on with some girl who wasn't there, I let her cut into my arm with her X-Acto knife, a little asterisk on my shoulder. She begged me to do it, and I liked it after, a little raised tattoo-like thing for me to run my fingers over. Jan had lots of places like that on her body. Who moved in next? Eleanor was British and sort of muscled her way in. She'd been crashing platonically in Jan's bed with her while Chantal lived in the other room. Chantal was a DJ who moved in with her underage runaway girlfriend. Hot, I thought. The girlfriend would tie up the phone, lying on the couch in the living room all day. Not so hot. Chantal and her would fuck in the shower, leaving behind little grenade-shaped big mouths of Mickey's. Eleanor had a huge fight with her, not over the girl or the booze, over the Buddhist meditation Chantal was doing in her room, the kind Tina Turner did, where you meditate for a car or more money. They pissed Eleanor off, and then Eleanor punched a hole through Chantal's door, and Chantal moved out, and Eleanor took her room. She made it beautiful, sponge-painted red and yellow with gold paint pen illustrations because Eleanor was an artist. Then Wendy moved in. I used to be in love with Wendy, too. She was tall and skinny, butch from Texas, and sang in bands, or she used to, but now she mostly smoked tons of pot like everyone who lived in that back room, the old office we rented out to bring our rent down. Wendy dated Lana Little, who had really outgrown the Blue House, and encouraged Wendy to outgrow it, which manifested as Wendy poking her head into my room at 10 o'clock at night while I was applying eyeliner for a night out and yelling, bad dad style, "You need to clean the crumbs off the table. I need to live with people who've got their shit together." This from someone who had spent the previous night smoking speed and playing hangman in the kitchen with Jan. Jan was wicked smart. She had math equations, tattoos on her body, and was vegan, a vegan drug addict. Anyway, Wendy had a bad back, and it would go out, and she would lie in her bed in tons of pain, expecting us all to take care of her, but we couldn't take care of ourselves. Like when Jan was sick for a week, and I went out every night getting wasted and tossing her the errant bottle of Odwalla, and it turned out she had, like, strep throat or bronchitis and a fever that could have brain damaged her. She didn't hold it against me, though. It's not like when I had that awful kidney infection, she suggested I lay off the sauce and quit being such a whore. That's not how we rolled at 251. I resented Wendy resenting my inability to fix her ramen and bring it to her in bed, where her mangy cats had peed and she was in too much pain to change the sheets. The whole scene was too grim. Eleanor would soon drive her out with her psychotic mood swings and love of picking fights. An evening of Eleanor banging her head against the living room door jamb as I attempted to write the great gay American novel was enough to make me want to move out if I thought I could survive outside the Blue House, which I doubted. After Wendy was Lou, who thought the Blue House would be a great place to get sober. I can barely address this folly. Lou would lie on the couch watching PBS all night while me and Jan were out sucking down cocktails. We would return and she would look at us and sadly talk about how crazy her life used to be, how wild and drunken, and how she'd flirted with death and whatnot. Now she had an environmental disorder that required visits to herbalists in Chinatown, who sold her a great mass of herbs and other things, like the casing of certain beetles, which she would make a great stinking tea of, the steam hanging malevolently in the kitchen among the roaches that Jan would not let us kill because she was vegan and loved all life. But at least Jan, unlike Joellen, made it fun. Jan painted their backs with blobs of glow-in-the-dark paint, so when you walked into a darkened room, you saw them first. Lou had been a vegetarian, but her herbalist told her body needed meat, and so she kept a little altar with paper images of cows and pigs and chickens upon it, so she could give them proper thanks for offering their lives to her own. I had mixed thoughts about this. Like, did she think the animals felt better about their slaughter just because she made some barnyard paper dolls and propped them up on a box? But more than anything, I didn't like to judge, so I left Lou to her animal worship and her other more exciting backroom activity, channeling. Lou channeled and was working on past life stuff. She channeled the Archangel Michael, who had answered her question, "What is the meaning of life?" with a number, delighting Jan, the mathematician, and also myself. I'd stolen Crowley Girl's Crowley book before she'd moved out, and had moved on to a bunch of books about the Kabbalah, and it sounded cosmically correct that the meaning of life was a number. Lou, a Taurus, eventually could no longer deal with the utter grossness of the house and moved out. She was replaced by Tanya, another Taurus who would not be able to deal with the utter grossness of the house. The house was really, really gross. Bookshelves were thick and dusty with books belonging to people none of us had ever known to live there. There were roaches. A damp towel under the leaking sink in the shower room had sprouted an otherworldly fungus that looked like conical lasagna noodles. Jan adored them. She tried to identify them with the help of several fungus picture books, but came up blank. Perhaps we had nurtured a new sort of fungus into existence. I finally threw it into the trash, then tied up the trash and threw it off the back stairs. It was so exhausting, walking it down to the yard. Also, I missed the trash can, and the bag exploded upon impact, releasing the fungal spores into the atmosphere. I had had the briefest of affairs with Tanya, another Brit, when she was visiting San Francisco during Pride. She was so cute with her mohawk and her turned-up nose and exotic accent. I fondly remember her tying me up with rope she purchased especially for that purpose. Then she went off to Reno, sent me a postcard, and when she returned, I didn't want to sleep with her again. I felt tied down very easily. Generally, if someone wanted to fuck me a second time, I felt suffocated, no matter the ardor which I may have pursued that initial fuck. So after getting that postcard, I was like, whoa, I'm a free agent here. And Tanya went back to London, only to return again as the back office's low rent occupant. Poor Tanya. She had arrived during Pride and thought that the city was like that all the time. She always wanted to go out, but I was writing more now and doing most of my drinking at poetry events, which bored the shit out of her. And so Tanya fell into a depression. She got medication for it, and then she fell asleep. All the time, everywhere. She would come home from her job at the Humane Society, snuggle down on the living room floor with all the animals she kept bringing home, despite me and Jan saying no to every one of them. With her dogs and cats and frogs, she would pass into a narcotic slumber on the floor. Poor Tanya also wanted a clean house. After what we'd been through with prior roommates, me and Jan made a point to tell potential inhabitants that we didn't clean, ever, and we didn't believe in chore wheels, and we didn't have house meetings. If you could handle it, our tough mocking tones suggested, you could live here. Everyone, no matter what their better judgment told them, wanted to give it a try. Because it was so cheap. Would it be okay if I cleaned? Tanya asked hesitantly. None of you would have to, I'd do it myself. I thought it was cute that Tanya thought our reluctance to clean was born of a hatred of cleanliness, rather than a side effect of alcoholism and deep laziness. I also thought it was cute that she would take on cleaning the Blue House like it was her own little art project. The Blue House was so toxically filthy, it had recently almost killed Jan and I. We both got staph infections in our noses. A regular nose picker, I thought the thin scab of staph up inside my nose was just an especially dry booger. Jan thought the same about hers. We had just returned from a poetry festival in New Mexico, which dries your boogers out so bad the scuzzy hotel we'd stayed at had a row of dry boogers stuck to the headboard by the last guest. Really, the Southwest was famous for dry boogers. Weeks later, and the scab booger situation was starting to creep me out. One of us went to the doctors, Jan with her medical insurance she got from her office job at SF General, me with my sliding scale status at the local clinic. The scale slid all the way down to free for me. A staph infection living up in our noses. We figured it happened when Jan was wrestling with her boyfriend in the kitchen. The area around the trash can was especially thick with grime, a tacky mat of organic mess stuck heavily to the stone floor. Jan's boyfriend, a handsome boor named Franklin, shoved her face into it and held it there. It's not like what it sounds like. It wasn't like abusive. Jan loved nothing more than to instigate impromptu fight club style activities. Her love for Franklin no doubt bloomed in the face of his violence. They kicked the shit out of each other, drunk, on the scuzzy floor, and Jan's face went into the diseased muck, and both somehow we got the infections up our nose, probably sharing cocaine dollars or something. I never even got to the parties, like my last one where I truth or dared a girl to put leftover rice in her ass crack and dared someone else to pour soy sauce on it and eat it out. I never got to the ghosts, the nightmares I had all the time, how terrible the long hallway felt in the middle of the night, the feeling that someone was behind you in the stairwell, the shadow Moira saw moving into rooms, how thick the big bathroom would feel with something that felt like evil. I didn't get to how I would throw all my dirty clothes out the window to the street below and then lug it over to the laundromat. I didn't get to that time I found a cockroach in my hair as I was falling asleep. I didn't get to court our landlord, who lived downstairs and sang sad songs on his personal karaoke machine, how his heartbreaking warble would drift up to our flat and kill us. There's so much I didn't get to, and so much that will never be gotten, because that house on the dumpiest street of the Mission just sold for $600,000, and whoever moves in will never know everything that happened under their very own roof. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Michelle T.